Welcome back, everybody, ladies and gentlemen, and anyone in between, to another fantastic episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast for thefilmstage.com. As always, I'm your host, Brian J. Rowan, and I'm here joined by my normal compatriots. There's Danny King, a writer for The Film Stage.
Hey, Brian.
What's up? I'm expecting an answer. Okay.
Oh, yeah, nothing.
Nothing at all.
Tuesday night.
You're a great guest. We're also going to have Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And a special guest this week to help us talk about the New York Film Festival, our editor-in-chief, our head honcho, our founder, our own personal Jesus, it's Jordan Rau.
Oh, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
No problem. Thanks for joining us. We are here to talk about the New York Film Festival. People who are listening may remember that last week we said we would be talking about Captain Phillips, but a funny thing happened on the way to the movie theater. Nick, I think you said that you were going to be kind of busy, and then I was going to be in Texas for the weekend for a wedding. I was still going to do my best to try to get out there and see the movie and find time to podcast in between just 3 days of hard drinking and fast living, but we decided that given everything that was happening, we were just going to push it off until midweek, and we'd have our brief Captain Phillips review followed by a full encapsulation of the time that you three spent at the New York Film Festival. So, not a full review, but more than you bargained for anyway, so we hope you're happy about that. And we will be back next weekend with a full review of the interesting, buzzy little film known as Escape from Tomorrow, the film that was secretly shot inside of Disney World or Disneyland. Does anyone remember?
Both, actually.
Both.
Actually, my living room.
Parts of it. Yeah, no, they went back and forth.
Between Danny's living room and Disney
World. Yeah, for
Disney World.
That's pretty weird. Anyway... So, let's talk to the two people who did see Captain Phillips, the new film by Paul Greengrass, and that is Danny King and Jordan Rau.
Well, I saw Paul Greengrass introduce my screening, so I guess mine's more important, right, Danny?
Yeah, you can go first. You're a lot more important.
All right. So I saw this actually on the opening night of New York Film Festival, which is fitting because this was the opening night film. So they showed they decided to show this, which is great. And No, as you might have seen from trailers or the real life story, this is the 2009 Somalian hijacking. And I guess we won't get into spoilers because who knows? Who knows what you know? But I would say this is a mostly thrilling film. But for me, it doesn't go kind of beyond that. There's some cool, like, back and forth. It shows the Somali pirate side from the beginning, which I really like that touch, and kind of bounces out, and there's some similarities in terms of Tom Hanks and the Somali pirates, how they're both kind of doing, just doing their job, which is cool, but I think it's kind of all surface level, and I think there's a little bit of a lull in the movie when it comes time in the second half, which we can talk about briefly if we want, but I thought this was fairly thrilling. That's just about it. What about you, Dan?
I actually quite liked Captain Phillips. I kind of went in, I feel like most people are positive on the movie, but there were a few kind of voices that were pretty negative, like our own Peter Labuza. Kind of whenever I've been running into him since he saw the film, he's just kind of been hating on it. And I think the one criticism of his that I definitely agree with is kind of when the film gets into its last third, it really does go heavy on like the Inception style score, which just feels really derivative and like a ripoff. And it just kind of bugged me. But I think overall the movie was a lot more interesting than I expected it to be, especially in terms of sort of like the depiction of the American Navy and how that sort of process worked, because there were a few kind of reviews that I read criticizing the film of like American patriotism and just sort of like green
gap. Oh my God, no.
Yeah.
Patriotism.
Well, you know, just talking about how Greengrass's style kind of pumps these men up. Like, you know, they come in and save the day, and then end of movie, America's great. But I think it's a lot more complicated than that. First of all, just because the situation that Tom Hanks's character finds himself in is just so, like, fucked up. There's no way for the Navy to come in and make a clean sort of analysis extraction of the situation, or a clean extraction, and come out looking like awesome dudes. I think there's a lot of moments where the Navy, you know, obviously they have to be professional about their work to get it done, but I think there are moments where you kind of are like, yeah, I don't know if I like these guys. Like, they're kind of not very sympathetic. And so I appreciated that. I think that, you know, Greengrass's strength is never like dialogue scenes. So I agree with Jordan that a lot of kind of the second half of the movie is sort of back and forth dialogue between Tom Hanks and the pirates and sort of this claustrophobic lifeboat. And a lot of those scenes just feel repetitive and almost like, it's almost like identical scene one after another, except with like a few words changed, where like Tom Hanks will say something and one pirate will be like, "Shut up, American." And then there's like a fight, and then it'll like cut to the next scene, and then it's the same thing. And also, Catherine Keener is in like the opening scene, which is just kind of awkward because she's like there and never in it again. But yeah, just like,
that was weird to me too. Can you guys hear me?
Uh-oh, who's this Forrest. New person we have on the podcast?
Forrest is here.
Forrest
has arrived.
Forrest, why don't you introduce yourself? Because we were looking for you earlier and you came in a little late.
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. Sorry. I don't know what to say. I'm Forrest. I saw some stuff at the New York Film Festival, figured I'd join in.
Do you have any
and
affiliations?
I'm
you
late
like
because I was reading about David Lynch.
You're reading about David Lynch.
Yeah, so that's why I'm late. Sorry about that.
All right. Do you have any affiliations you want to drop on us? Any bona fides you'd like us to put out there?
I don't think so, no.
Okay.
I'm just a guy who writes for the film stage like the rest of you.
All right. Fantastic. Did you see Captain Phillips?
Yeah, I did.
All right. Why don't you give us your brief spoiler-free thoughts on it?
Kind of like Danny said, I think the second half gets a bit repetitive. And the beginning, there's two scenes at the beginning that I think are supposed to be important and sort of set up the difference between like growing up in America versus growing up in a less developed country. But to me, it didn't work at all. So the politics of the film just seemed completely flat. It was just American exceptionalism. Yay, we did it. Sort of like Argo, but less thrilling.
I see. Isn't it? I mean, here's the thing, though. When we bring up stuff like American exceptionalism and yay, we did it. I mean, in these cases, we did do it. So it's not like this is a fiction that was concocted just to make us feel better. Like, this is an actual accomplishment of ours, correct? Like, almost like 0
to
30.
So, but I think there's more of a story there.
Okay.
In that, like, you get the throwaway line about how all their fish has been taken so they can't fish. So there's like a story about why this needs to happen or why this happened in the first place that goes completely unexplored.
All right.
Actually, now that you brought up Zero Dark Thirty, I think that's sort of a good way to illustrate why I sort of like Captain Phillips maybe more than something like Argo, because like Jessica Chastain's character in that film, I did really get kind of a committed performance out of Tom Hanks. And, you know, like the last 5 minutes of the film, like everyone's saying, really knock me out. And he sort of leaves you on this really sort of ambiguous and almost like terrifying note. And it's sort of similar to what you got at the end of Zero Dark Thirty, whereas something like Argo, which is a fine film, but you don't really get much of a character out of the guy Ben Affleck is playing, for me.
Yeah, agreed. I thought a lot less comedy in Captain Phillips.
A lot less comedy.
A little bit. I think the reason that... Sorry, go ahead, Nick.
I literally just said Captain Phillips could fuck yourself, as in, because it was the thank you. Hello, everybody. I'll
the
go
reason
back to
for me that Zero Dark 30 works is because it questions why we did it, and it questions whether or not it was worth the cost. And I don't think Captain Phillips or Argo does that.
Well, what was the cost in Captain Phillips?
Exactly. Well, what was the cost of Captain Phillips?
Again, that's reality. Right?
Well,
I can understand this. I mean, from a story point, are you saying that in general you don't believe the event itself was enough to sustain film? Like, you think that the screenwriter just didn't bother trying to look for something else?
Yeah, it didn't look at the surrounding issues enough. And also, I think the second half gets... I don't want to say exactly when because it's sort of a spoiler, but at a certain point I thought it just got really repetitive and boring.
Okay. Yeah, we decided we weren't going to do spoilers, even though this is a real story that happened 3 years ago.
Yeah.
Oh, God. That's just where we're at, man. That's where we're at. I mean, Quentin Tarantino changed the end of World War II, so I guess it's possible that there could be spoilers in a real-life story. Oh, man. Anyway, we won't be getting into spoilers at all, so no one has to worry about us going into that. But were there any other final thoughts to give to this film before we jumped into the New York Film Festival as a whole?
Yeah, I would say Captain Phillips.
Just one more thing.
Well,
Jordan, do you want to go?
Yeah, I was going to say.
No, I'm just going to highlight Tom Hanks' performance. I think it's really strong, and he kind of carries the movie. And especially, like you said, his final scenes. It's a tense experience. So kind of, I know Nick will be mad, but if you're looking for something after Gravity that can get close to the tension of that movie, this will work.
Oh, man. All right, Danny, what do you want to say?
Just really briefly, kind of ties into my point about sort of how I felt the portrayal of the American forces were multidimensional. One unique thing about the hostage situation in the film is that there's really never a moment where you think these pirates are actually going to get anything for what they're doing. It's really sort of like a dead end situation they find themselves in. And at a certain point, like whenever they bring up money, it's almost like a joke. Like, they're just kind of like, yeah, when are we going to get our $10 million? And Tom Hanks just kind of looks at them like, what are you, like, talking about? Like, that's not a thing that's going to happen. So there are a lot of almost, like, really awkward interactions between the Navy and the pirates where the Navy's like, yeah, we got the money. Don't worry. Like, it's on the way. And, like, all these Navy officers are, like, looking at each other like, wait, like, this isn't real. Like, am I acting well? Like... So, like, I don't know. I like those scenes.
All right. Well, that's it for Captain Phillips. It's out in theaters now. It took number 2 at the box office this weekend, following up Gravity, which held on very well, which I'm happy to be able to report. So go check it out if you feel the need. Until then, let's talk about some of the big movies that came to the New York Film Festival. The first we'll talk about is a film that's actually coming into select theaters this coming weekend. And that is All Is Lost.
Yes. I think I was I, anyone else see it? No.
I saw it.
Oh, you did? All right. Yeah, I actually saw
it.
Were you at the
Press and Industries screening?
Yes.
Oh, so did you, were you at the Q&A when somebody asked Robert Redford the worst question in the history of festival Q&As?
No, I had to split in order to make it to class.
Oh.
What was the question?
Someone asked Robert Redford, question. Is All Lost?
After seeing the film, I mean, it's a horrible question, but I can see why someone would say that. But anyways.
But is she talking about?
That's ridiculous.
About, like, life?
I was about to say, what if he could have saved her?
Yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, so that's an interesting thing that we'll just let hang in the air. So yeah, what were the thoughts on All Is Lost, which is, for people who don't know, the new film starring Robert Redford about a man who has to survive on the open sea after a shipwreck. I guess
it's
a wreck.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. They Well, first of all, a little background, which I think is kind of interesting to the project, is this is from director J.C. Chandor, who brought Margin Call to Sundance, which is like a financial thriller that is just set in a boardroom that features only talking for about an hour and a half. And then he turned around and made this movie, which has about, I think, 10 to 15 lines of dialogue throughout the whole thing.
Classic auteurism.
Yeah. So it was actually interesting to see, because I mean, Margin Call kind of had, like, you know, it was an efficient movie, like it did what it had to do, but I was really interested to see if All Is Lost would kind of, you know, if he could visually tell this story. And it's not something like Gravity, where, you know, these thoughts, these shots were obviously thought out for a long period of time. But yeah, I would say like suspense is contained within the runtime. It's all Robert Redford. I really, really like the structure of the movie, because literally the first shot of the movie, well, there's like a little preamble, and then one of the early shots is his ship gets punctured, and it's like almost like tons of water starts pouring in, and that's like one of the early shots in the movie, and then it goes 8 days after from there. So it's really crazy, that aspect of it. But yeah, I mean, I would love to kind of read the script for this, considering the lack of dialogues. And I wonder just how much were like set pieces he thought of, or if there's actually a lot of detail. But yeah, I mean, Robert Redford gives a great performance, keeps your attention. It's a little too spare of a movie, which sounds like a silly complaint. But I would say there's a section almost like Captain Phillips where it changes gears. And it didn't hold my interest as much when that gear shifts. Yeah, I don't know. Forrest, what did you think?
I actually thought that how spare it was the best thing about it, because it never pretends to be anything than just Robert Redford on a boat trying to survive. And that means you can make anything you want of it.
True.
And I've heard a few people complain about there's like a certain – they say there's a certain point where it loses them a bit. And I guess I was so swept up with it that, no pun intended, that I didn't know, like, I don't know where that point is. I don't know when it loses people. Okay. I was engaged the entire time. Redford is great. There's a couple things that irk me. There's a melodramatic moment where he curses. That didn't work for me. I thought that kind of broke the spell. And then I don't know if I like the preamble, but if it's a 110-minute movie, about 108 of them work for me.
That's good.
All right. So, yeah, that's a good percentage.
Just because it lets you make from it whatever you want to make from it. And I can appreciate that. I also didn't see Margin Call.
Oh.
So,
no, Margin Call is a fine movie.
Yeah. I would say it's a step up. Margin Call.
Is there a problem with me calling it a fine movie, Danny?
No, it's just like your voice dropped off at the end. You were like, oh, it's fine, whatever.
All right, well, that's All Is Lost. And like I said, that's coming to theaters this coming weekend. It'll be in limited release. So look for it, sort of, I guess. We have two divergent opinions.
No, I mean, I'm definitely for it. I think
yeah, but you're more like tempered than...
Yeah, I'm not all out. All is not lost.
All is not lost for this movie. Oh, God. I was thinking while you all were talking of all the terrible, terrible puns that I could have made, but I decided against it. So let's move on to the next one. Blue is the warmest color. This won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, and it will be coming November? December?
No, in a week.
In a week?
No, I think, the 25th.
October 25th, yeah.
Oh, damn. If it would... I'm still so close. Okay. So this will be coming out October 24th.
I mean, it'll be a painfully slow rollout because it's not going to VOD and it's from IFC Films, so it'll be very slow.
A lot of limited releases.
Yeah, and it's not playing in Idaho. If you're in Idaho, at a
oh right,
the entirety of Idaho has
no. There was just one theater that said it doesn't fall into their county code jurisdiction because there's something. You know, because as someone might know, there's like a 10-minute extended lesbian sex scene. And so this theater in Idaho is just like, yep, we're not going to show this.
Oh, well, that's crazy. Well, as we now know, this is the story of a 10-minute lesbian sex scene. Now, okay, so who saw this movie? Who wants to give us a quick synopsis and let us know?
I did, but Danny can talk first.
I could talk first. That would that would have required me having seen the film.
Wait, who else saw it?
Forrest.
Oh, Forrest. I saw it.
All right.
I should have given it a try. Just to see if I could fool you.
You should have.
If you saw Goodbye First Love, that would have been a good starting point.
Oh yeah.
Oh, Goodbye First Love. That's a movie that I'm
so
all right with.
I guess this is a movie that's sort of like Goodbye First Love, in that these two girls essentially fall in love with one another when it starts in high school, and it sort of follows her over the next few years, and the younger girl has trouble sort of accepting openly that she's a lesbian. And it's a lot of it is just sort of her discovering herself and learning to accept herself in that respect. And there's a 10-minute lesbian sex scene, but it's a 179-minute movie, so that's not most of it. And
tell us more.
I don't know what else
scene.
To say than that.
it is weird how that. I mean, if we want to actually get to like the technical aspects of it, how it stands apart from the movie, just in terms of like stylistically speaking, because like literally from the first, it's gonna sound funny, but from the first frame of the movie, the camera is just like on almost on her face, or at least kind of close. The main character, who I think she gives an amazing performance, Adele Archipopoulos. I butchered it, but anyways, this is we follow her, and Lee Sedoux is just kind of I would say like more of a supporting character, because we follow Adele the whole time. But yeah, the most of the movie is just her literally like this director who this was the first film I saw from him.
Same.
Kachiche, yeah. He did Secret of the Grain or something like that, which I haven't seen. But yeah, I really like the style, in terms of, you know, most of the film is shot in close ups. And whether it's like they're eating oysters, like any food they're eating is like really clearly highlighted and like a major part of every scene.
A strangely recurring theme or motif.
But then when for the sex scene, it feels he just like kind of like gets more into like master shots, and it's kind of an odd transition. Like I don't know why he does that, and because he couldn't film it any other way. But I mean, or just because he had what.
It's an interesting word, master shots.
I don't know what
lesbian sex scene.
Yes, but yeah, no, it was just like an odd transition. It just felt like he wanted to create this little short film inside. It didn't flow, you know.
He just wanted to film two attractive girls. That's basically what you just said. He just wanted to film two attractive girls.
See, that's the problem, is that everybody's saying that, and it's. I mean, it's such a small percentage of the movie at the end of the day. And I think the reason I think it works is both of the actresses are sort of saying they'll never work with him again. And they mentioned that the sex scenes weren't choreographed.
Yeah.
And I think they're very obviously not choreographed, which is great, because this is a movie about Adele discovering her sexuality, and it's her first lesbian encounter, and she has no idea what to do or what it's supposed to be like, and having these wide shots where you see both of their bodies just tangling in with one another it's so erratic and bizarre.
So this is the lesbian sex scene equivalent of the scene in Alien where the thing bursts out of John Hurt's chest and no one in the cast knew.
Well, okay. We can stop talking about that scene, because there's a lot.
I was going
to
say this.
Great stuff
now,
to talk about.
Obviously, the lesbian sex has been a big part of the quote unquote controversy around the film, and they have said some stuff about the director and everything, but I mean, this is a film that won the Palme d'Or. We've all seen some Palme d'Or winners before, I assume. Do we feel like it lives up to being included in that pantheon?
Well, for me, I was just a little let down. I mean, I think he hits all the right like emotional beats throughout, and it's a film that by the end, even though it was 3 hours, I was still very much tied to the relationship. But with that said, like it is a film that I feel like, even though it hits all the emotional beats, all like the story beats and the structure is something you've seen in like countless other romances like this. So it didn't really break new ground in that aspect. Not that it really had to, but because it did the other aspects so well. But it wasn't a movie that, you know. I'll just leave it at that.
No, I'm with you. I'm a big fan but I mean, it's a longer version of Goodbye First Love with a bit of the Lucas Moodysson movie thrown in there, the one from the late 90s. I felt like I had seen it before, and for a three-hour movie, it's incredibly well-paced. But as a Palme d'Or winner, it's not what I expect.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, let's move on to a larger film, a film that will be hitting wide come Christmas, and that is The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which is directed by Ben Stiller and starring Ben Stiller as well. And it's based on the short story by James Thurber. And unfortunately, if you've read the short story, and it's kind of a staple in high schools, you should know it. It from the trailer, it does not look like it hews at all to the story. So we'll use that as a jumping off point. Danny, you saw this, correct?
Yeah.
So give us your thoughts.
But let's spend less time on this movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, because no one else has seen it.
Yes.
So yeah, pretty briefly, like,
is it something that we should spend the next 2 months looking forward to?
No.
Oh,
that's
Jesus,
a pretty big question.
Wow. He sounded
Yeah, no, that's a really big question. But I actually gave it like a positive review. Because I went to the first press screening, and afterwards when the Q&A started, it was kind of a boring Q&A. So I was kind of like looking at Twitter. And right away, the response kind of seemed like quite negative towards the film. But to me, it's just like not my idea of a film that deserves a pan. It's just like a nice kind of movie. Like you said, the short story is very short for one thing, and it's almost plotless. So it's gonna be very different. And Stiller puts a lot of effort into making the story contemporary. So his character works at Life magazine as a photo editor, and the magazine is transitioning into an all digital sort of thing. So it's a pretty blatant metaphor for like the shift from analog to digital. And so that was kind of cool because he plays around with photographs and stuff, which is pleasant. And yeah, he ends up going to Greenland and Iceland and then comes back to New York and it's happy.
Would you say that the transition from a print physical media to online for a magazine called Life is also a metaphor for the shifting of our own social circles from the real world into the digital realm?
I would not. He was looking at Twitter.
Danny,
I
lied
about
that.
At Twitter.
No, I don't use the internet.
This was an incredibly fantastically divisive movie on Twitter coming out of it. A lot of people were saying it was like a treacly misfire, and some were like, oh, it's, you know, a rousing reaffirmation of the human spirit or something like that. Like,
yeah.
You're saying it's just kind of, it's an okay
film.
Well,
I think part of the problem is that Stiller, you know, he directed this movie and he cast himself in the lead role, and the lead role is very much like sort of this hardworking man who's supposed to stand for, like, I don't know, the face of the working class or something. And so I think he's been accused by some people of like making the film into a vanity project. But to me, I sort of like that he's directing it and acting it, because it makes it feel like kind of like a passion piece, even though it's not like a great film or a particularly passionate one. It feels nice to have him acting in the film because you feel like he's invested in it, as opposed to, you know, if someone else was in it. I liked his performance, and I usually like him. So, you know, if you go into this and you don't like Ben Stiller, that's probably
it's a red flag.
Yeah, that's probably a red flag.
All right. Did anyone else get a chance to see this?
Nope.
I'll take that as a no.
Yeah.
All right. Next, let's talk to Nick, who's going to tell us a little bit about Stray Dogs.
Yes, Stray Dogs. One of maybe the best movie of the festival that I saw. Or no, second best. Very close. This is already going so well. Stray Dogs is the new film from Taiwanese filmmaker Simon Lang, best known for his 2003 picture, Goodbye Dragon Inn. By most accounts, this is actually going to be his final film. He sort of indicated that retirement is in the cards for him. And they say that as a last film, it's a wonderful encapsulation of all his works. I'm actually a Psy neophyte, I'm sorry to say. But nevertheless, this movie really kind of knocked me back. It basically consists of, I would say, the movie's 138 minutes. The movie consists of less than 100 shots. And each image is so rigidly composed, and it's so particular that basically from the first shot, which is a woman who is brushing her hair while two children sleep in a bed, this image goes on for, I would say, at least 4 minutes. I was completely gripped. And there's a narrative in there, but it is a bit tricky just in the sense that everything he's presenting to you is initially context-free, and each image kind of has these new visual signifiers, which you're adding up until you get something a bit more coherent. And then the movie makes this shift in its second half to sort of a different... It pertains to two characters who were in the first half of the film, but it goes in sort of an unexpected direction. In my review of the film, I compared it most prominently to Chantal Ackerman's John Delman. Those of you who have seen that movie, either here or listening, can get some idea of what that would entail. Although it's about 70 minutes shorter, it is similar accord. Sort of this methodical, slow type of cinema, which emphasizes the more shocking moments to sometimes an almost unbearable degree. There were some things which happened in this movie I couldn't quite believe. As you probably heard, there's something like a 10-minute shot where a guy crying eats a head of cabbage.
You're really selling this thing, man.
outside of the context of the film, you might think to yourself, well, what is the purpose behind that? But when you see the movie and you see everything the character has gone through, it's this really despairing, heart-wrenching scene, which I just sort of – I felt physically uncomfortable watching it. But it was a great experience overall. It's an absolutely beautiful film too. It was shot digitally, and he uses the technical freedoms of digital very well in the way these shots go on. I think the last two of the film run for about 25 minutes or so. And I mean, when it ended, I kind of wasn't exactly sure what to say, which is funny because I don't think I've ever taken so many notes during a film as I did during this. So yeah, I'm a really big fan of it. I don't know if anyone else here saw it or if I'm the only one. Anybody?
Sounds like maybe.
No.
Okay.
Give us your wrap up and we'll move on to something
else. Yeah, it doesn't yet have distribution. I feel like because Simon Lang is not really a small name in the international cinema circuit, I feel like, you know, like Cinema Guild or something, maybe IFC could pick it up. Hopefully. Hopefully it comes out. But I have no idea. So
we will keep an eye on that.
Quality motion picture.
Maybe the Weinsteins will pick it up. Cut 40 minutes from it and
yeah,
it into
yeah,
a romantic comedy. So now that we've had the tale of a 10-minute scene of a man eating a head of cabbage, lettuce,
cabbage
and crying, let's move on to some lighter fare. Let's talk about The Immigrant. That's a joke.
I see what you did there.
Yeah. All right.
I think that's a joke because I didn't see either movie.
I'm So this is director James Gray. It's his follow-up to Two Lovers. Previous to that, he made Little Odessa, The Yards, and We Own the Light. We Own the Night.
It's a statement on cinema.
It's pretty amazing. We Own the Night. And who had a chance to check out this one?
I did.
All right, excellent. So, Jordan, we haven't heard from you in a tick, so why don't you give us a brief synopsis and your thoughts on this film?
Yeah, brief synopsis. The film mainly concerns three characters, one being Marion Cotillard, who arrives to New York, Ellis Island, as an immigrant, as you could guess. And
as a
quickly,
customs officer.
Yeah, and she arrives with her sister, who is suffering from what we soon learn is tuberculosis. So her sister's going to be locked up for around 6 months at an infirmary in Ellis Island, and she might be sent back to where she came from. But Joaquin Phoenix's character comes upon her. We don't really know what his deal is yet, but he kind of rescues her, and she goes to live with him. And we soon learn that he runs a kind of entertainment type place, but also crossed with like a brothel out of his own home. And yeah, and it kind of goes downhill for her from there. Jeremy Renner factors in as like a magician who is Joaquin Phoenix's cousin, and it's kind of the melodrama that concerns their three characters and kind of a love triangle. Yeah, but I'm a huge James Gray fan. I've really enjoyed all of his features. He might not always have like the best scripts, but he really sells the world, and I think his cinematography is always gorgeous. Production design and here is no different. The film, I think, is a touch too melodramatic for me, at least. There's a lot of themes that kind of seem hammered in, which isn't necessarily different from something like We Own the Night, but here it just felt a little false where it didn't in his other movies, but still recommended. But yeah, I was probably a little more mixed on it than I was hoping.
And Nick?
I'm quite positive on The Immigrant. I do agree that the movie is very blunt, and that is sort of the melodramatic facet of it playing out, which I can understand and I can appreciate, but it did feel a bit pointed for my taste. Nevertheless, though, it is a very good film. I think that James Gray is... it's funny how he kind of always prides himself on being a storyteller, because I think he's best at creating atmosphere and mood, which is certainly the case in this movie, where a lot of it looks like Once Upon a Time in America or the flashback portions of The Godfather Part 2. The design of the cinematography has this very earthy brown to it, which I found sort of intoxicating. And it's a beautiful, although most of it is interior, there's some beautiful outdoor photography, in particular one scene where Marion Cotillard and Joaquin Phoenix are running from the police and they dash through Central Park. And I think the best image in the movie is when they go in the sewer and the cops are beating Joaquin Phoenix with their nightsticks, and their flashlights are the only thing which is creating lights in that environment. It's this completely beautiful sight, and I was it was things like that which kind of were keeping me more into the film as I found the narrative drifting a bit. But it is a well-constructed movie, and I also think that we should give a special mention to Jeremy Renner, who I keep saying is sort of the movie's ace in its hole, in a way, because he's the one who ties the movie together most significantly with his supporting role, and it's also the best performance he's ever given, which I've never been a huge Jeremy Renner fan, so maybe that sounds like I'm damning with faint praise, but it's very, very good. And Joaquin Phoenix as well. It feels like an entirely new performance from him. It feels entirely different from the other stuff he's done with James Gray, which is excellent too. And Marion Cotillard, who I've always been kind of mixed on, I did like here a lot. You forget that she's actually French and not Polish. So if you are a fan of James Gray, I would say be excited for it. Unfortunately, you might not see it in an optimal environment, because it's funny you mentioned the Weinstein Company, as they've sort of been giving James Gray a bit of grief over this film, and they're probably going to release it through Radius, their VOD company. Mm-hmm. So it'll get a limited theatrical release, which is too bad, because it's an absolutely beautiful looking film and it should be seen on a big screen. I consider myself lucky I got to see it on a big screen. Most people are not going to have that opportunity. And I don't know why, because I feel like, you know, Harvey Weinstein is so obsessed with winning Academy Awards. This movie, just across the board, could earn nominations for so much. It's weird that he would...
Like the period detail.
The period detail, the performances. I don't know what he's... I don't know what's going on with that guy. So... All
right. When will this be out?
The first quarter of next year.
First quarter of next year. All right, so look for it in the first quarter of next year.
Nothing specific yet, that's why.
All right. Well, we'll keep you informed, and let's move on to the next film, Bastards. Let's talk about her. Ah! Terrible joke. Anyway, so let's talk about the new film, Bastards. Who got a chance to see this?
I did.
Yeah.
That was so retiring. All right. Someone go for it. Let's give us a brief synopsis and thoughts on the film.
Hey, someone else start this one out.
Danny?
Yeah, I can introduce the film Bastards.
The film Bastards? Oh, that's our new podcast title.
So yeah, the film begins with a suicide in the middle of the night while it's pouring outside, and it just gets darker from there.
Sweet. I'm in. This is my favorite film of this year.
Yeah, so that's the opening scene of Bastards.
Spoiler alert.
Okay. It's a very artful suicide. But yeah. So it actually has a pretty windy plot involving sort of these like corrupt business leaders and their families and their children and stuff like that. And it's deliberately confusing for a lot of the film. The sort of main character is played by Vincent Linden, and he's a captain who kind of comes in from the sea to comfort his family after this said suicide. And he sort of sets out to get revenge on the man and the family of the man he thinks is responsible. This entails his courting of a woman. And there's a pretty amazing moment where it's pretty inexplicable, but it's like he takes off his shirt, and he drops like a pack of cigarettes from a balcony while she's walking on the sidewalk. And she like picks them up and looks up at him, and he's like shirtless, and it's just kind of like, yeah,
great
like
shot.
That's
great,
that's
shot.
Like a move I just did. So okay. that's sort of a nice moment. But yeah, so this film is directed by Claire Denis, and it's her first digital film, and that sort of has resonance in terms of kind of how cold the subject matter is. But that's sort of also what turned me off from the film, because though Denis has made a lot of very provocative and often disturbing films, the ones I respond to most have an element of humanism there, like Beau Travail or 35 Shots of Rum might be my number one out of what I've seen. Whereas this dark, and it saves its sort of strongest gut punches for literally the final images. So I don't know how much the film really worked for me emotionally, but it is, you know, it's a very well-made Claire Denis film that's worth seeing. So I would recommend it.
All right. Nick, what about yourself?
This is my favorite movie of the festival of all of them I've seen. As a big Claire Denis fan, I suppose I am kind of predisposed toward it because it is very much hers. It is unmistakably the work of Claire Denis. I think that for me, it actually feels like a pretty major step in her career because it's her first time working with digital, and her films are much more dependent upon their sort of visual tactile design than their screenplays would be. And, I think that she transplants to this new format beautifully, and she puts it to great use. I was enthralled from it from pretty much the first shot, which is this extremely heavy, extremely imposing rainfall. And from there, the progression of her story is something that I just find very stimulating, the way she cuts everything down to its most essential element. And because of that, once you get into the movie's rhythm, or rather, if you do get into the movie's rhythm at all, once that happens, each moment is so powerful and it becomes almost overbearing. There's one brief, something like 30-second scene between an old man and a kid that made me almost sick to my stomach, because we've been told very clearly what this person is capable of and what the circumstances are. And there are no words spoken in that entire moment, but it communicates so much. And that to me is the movie in a nutshell, is how forcefully each moment comes through. The last 2 minutes, I was sort of inhaling and exhaling through my nose with such force that I was actually worried I was like disturbing the people next to me because I was so shaken by what was playing out on screen. It's the most horrifying thing I've seen in a movie this year, and I loved it. I loved the experience of it. So yeah, Bastards. It's absolutely one of my favorite films of the year. And thankfully, it's coming out soon. I think Sundance Flix will release it 8 days from today, on October 23rd. So you can see it soon.
All right, excellent, Jordan. What about yourself?
Yeah, Nick pretty much stole everything I was going to say. So I really love this movie. I'd only previously seen two of her films, and this one kind of caught me off guard. Because I really had no idea what to expect. I think I even read, because I edited it, I read Raffi's review from Cannes, and he did a great job after I saw the movie at going back and reading it, but I guess I just didn't pick up on some of the details. But anyways, yeah, this is a very dark, dark film, and which is kind of my bread and butter, so I was all for that. And yeah, like Nick said, the structure of this is just, it's incredible. Like, I feel like if it was done in a more conventional way, it still obviously would have been great, but just the way, you know, there's a scene where a main character gets, like, beat up, and it just comes out of nowhere, and then you can slowly piece that together maybe three to four scenes later. And I just love when a film like this that is, she actually refers to it, I think, as, like, a nocturnal thriller, which is perfect. It's just, I think the vast majority takes place, in night, as people are either creeping around their vast, like, places where they live, or other areas. We go to some other dark places, both literally speaking. So it's really strong movie. If you can, I know it's coming out on VOD, but it's also coming out of the theaters, at the same time. So if you can see it in the theater, I would highly recommend it. Fantastic score by Tindersticks. Frequent collaborators with Denis. So, yeah.
All right. So let's talk about our final movie, the newest film by director Spike Jonze. And this is Her, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Amy Adams, Olivia Wilde, and the voice of Scarlett Johansson. Who is the lucky bastard who got a chance to see this? All of you. Fantastic. It's good I saved this for last. Not even knowing that. That's how preternatural my talent is as a host. So, we haven't heard from Forrest in a bit.
Oh, no. Do I have to do plot summary?
I could give you a plot summary.
Oh, man. Okay. So, Joaquin Phoenix, he lives in futuristic LA, unspecified time in the future. It looks really nifty. Part of it was shot in Shanghai. That's why. And he falls in love with Operating System 1, also known as Samantha, voiced by Scarlett Johansson. She's fantastic in it. And it sort of goes from there.
Okay. What were your thoughts on this film?
I couldn't get into it. It's effective emotionally, which I don't mean that as a bad thing, but to me, the concept of the movie is so interesting, and it sort of glosses over a lot of really interesting questions, I think, without coming back to them. So I would have liked to see it to be as a more intellectually challenging film, and it sort of doesn't try to be that. So I suppose it's not fair to say that it's not a good movie because it goes straight for your heartstrings, because that's what it does. It goes for your heartstrings, and to a large extent it works, but I wish it challenged me more. And I think there's so much potential in that story that largely went untapped.
All right. Danny King, what about yourself?
As people say something else, I'm sure I'll have more thoughts and want to jump in. But
yeah.
Right.
That's where I am for now.
Well, yeah, I think I kind of agree with Forrest here. The movie like really didn't leave much of an impact on me, and I was also, occasionally emotionally moved, but never really kind of stimulated thematically. And I think part of my problem in approaching the movie is that, like, sort of struggling to figure out who Spike Jonze is as a filmmaker, because, like, this is the first script he's written. And so, like, when I think of on the films he's made before, I almost don't think of him as the author of them, even though he's a very visually astute director. I just think of, like, if I think of Being John Malkovich, I think of Charlie Kaufman, Adaptation, Charlie Kaufman, Where the Wild Things Are. That's more Jones, but also very influential source material. And so with a movie like Her, the whole concept to me felt like Charlie Kaufman, and it almost felt like second rate Charlie Kaufman. So I don't even know how much of Spike Jonze's voice is like in the concept of this movie. And that was one thing that I was just like struggling with during the movie is like, you know, because like I said, I was kind of not that engaged by it. So I was thinking about other things like this. and I still haven't really figured it out. So maybe these other guys can help.
All right. Well, let's see if Jordan can help.
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely more positive on it. I think this is where Danny's point comes in that Spike Jonze has always had like a great, he really sells the world that he is making, whether it be, you know, Where the Wild Things Are or Malkovich. I would say Adaptation, yeah, to a lesser extent. But yeah, with this movie, the thing that after seeing it that I keep going back to is just how effective he has made this kind of futuristic world. I think Nick posited that it could be like 2025, which sounds about right. And whether it's like the cinematographer who how do you pronounce his name? Anyone know off the top of their head?
Nope.
Hoyt de Homan or something like that. Anyways, he's the guy who's shooting in Interstellar right now, and he also shot Tinker Tailor, Soldier Spy, Let the Right One In. And I think Spike Jonze said in the Q&A that he made the movie, he wanted to make the movie feel like Jamba Juice or something like that. And it kind of conveys, I mean, every part of this movie is like, whether it's Joaquin Phoenix's like shirt he's wearing, which is always some color or like some beautiful color that's not in the normal spectrum, or like the offices that he lives in. Anyways, it just feels like almost like an Apple store that, you know, the whole world has been turned into an Apple store, which I kind of can see being the future, sadly, kind of. And so that's what I kept coming back to. And then with that, yes, the central relationship, while it's much more convincing than I thought, because the trailer could almost seem like it's like a Funny or Die sketch a little bit. but he does sell that, which I was kind of surprised by, much in part due to Scarlett Johansson's strong voice performance. The relationship, though, it does meander, and there's not really, I mean, if his point was to kind of show, you know, how close someone could come to this, to having, you know, like a realistic relationship, he conveys that. But in terms of like an arc, it's kind of spare, I would say. Still recommend.
Okay, Nick Newman.
Yeah, I actually wrote the review of this film, so technically I don't have to speak at all, but because I like our audience so much, I will do that.
Just write out the URL for people.
I liked her very much. I was I do agree that the central relationship between Theodore Twombly and Samantha, the computer, was a little dry and it was a little distanced for myself, but I somehow think that's part of the idea, is because we're not really supposed to. I can't figure out if there's sort of an ironic distance this movie is taking with the relationship, because of course it's a strange thing, and the movie plays it on the surface, it plays it earnestly, but I can't figure out if there's something else going on under there. And I mostly suspect that because of Spike Jonze himself and the films he's made before that, and how they didn't really have a world of sincerity to them, except Where the Wild Things Are. But this is much closer in spirit, I think, to Being John Malkovich or Adaptation, in part because it's about a schlubby guy. That's part of it too. But I think that Jordan, I keep coming back to the design of the movie, which really caught me off guard, because I had no idea the film was supposed to be set in the near future. And I actually didn't read any of his comments. It's weird how the movie premiered just, you know, like 72 hours ago, and suddenly Spike Jonze is going off saying, yeah, it's absolutely set in the near future, because there's nothing in the movie that really suggests this. Just the design of it, I should say. There's no lines of dialogue which would play to that. And that, to me, is my favorite kind of science fiction world building, where there isn't really world building, where you're just kind of observing. And, I mean, if I get more pleasure from that than anything else, I don't see it as a huge issue, because there are still a number of very good things outside of it. Again, quite like Joaquin Phoenix here. Again, a different performance from him. Scarlett Johansson, I think, is incredible in this film. In my review, I actually called it one of the best voice performances ever put to film. And I will stick by that. I really do think it is one of the best voice performances I've ever heard. Because it's this really difficult role, and you buy her as a character. You kind of do for a bit forget that she is a computer. That was excellent. And, you know, yeah, the movie is a real pleasure to look at, too. The colors are very expressive, but also kind of inhibited, which plays to sort of the environment that Jonze is creating. Yeah, if its screenplay isn't completely tight, I guess I feel like, you know, this is the first feature screenplay he's written by himself. So as a start, it's actually pretty good, I think. And yeah, Her is a strong film. I look forward to seeing it again. Poor me, I saw the film more than 2 months before it comes out, and I have to wait. Pity me, everyone who hasn't seen it yet.
Can I jump back in for a second?
Please.
Sorry. First of all, I completely agree with you on Scarlett Johansson. And she's so good in this film that it almost just feels like a regular romantic comedy between two people.
Mm-hmm.
And then they go through like a bit of a, you know, like she's...
Yeah, like they're just talking
You almost fall into the same trap that Theodore does. You almost fall in love with the computer because she's so good in it. And the world building, so to speak, is what kept me into the movie, because the fact that she makes just like a regular romantic comedy is somewhat paradoxically what sort of keeps me at a distance with the movie. Is because if she weren't so humanistic in that role as a computer, I would sort of question the relationship between a human and a computer more, or the film would have sort of more of an opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I almost think that this is a performance that is so good that it ends up hurting the movie just by comparison, because nothing else can sort of come up to that level. Does that make sense at all?
Yeah, sure. I would
give a shout out though,
sure,
to Rooney Mara, who half of her performance is in a flashback and that stuff. I don't know, just because maybe some of the things they did were kind of relatable, but really, by the way, she plays his soon to be ex wife in the movie, they've been estranged for like a year. And anyways, the movie is a lot of her performance is told through flashbacks, and yeah, really strong, I thought. And even the way Spike Jonze put them into the film, just like structurally, it was really well done, I thought. So, sorry, Nick.
No, it's fine. I was going to say, I wonder how, as has been sort of publicized, Samantha Morton was originally going to have that role. She actually, I believe she did do a voice performance, and then obviously it was not used. And Samantha Morton, if she wasn't talking with her accent, if she talks in an American accent, has a much flatter voice. So I have to wonder how that would have affected the movie. I'd be curious to see a version of this, because surely the audio is still out there. So I'd be curious to see a version where it does play that way. But
yeah, he actually said that she was on set the whole time, and they were
right.
So it's kind of interesting.
I think he started putting it together in post, and he realized it didn't work. So he went back and cast someone else.
Yeah.
I remember reading that Scarlett Johansson came in after post-production had started.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's...
I think they should have got Brian.
Hey, guys.
it's an interesting film, even though it didn't work for me. And it was my first Spike Jonze, period.
Really?
So, I haven't seen... Didn't see Malkovich, Adaptation, or Where the Wild Things Are. I guess I saw his Arcade Fire short, but this is
one of his best.
For all intents and purposes, kind of my first it was my first feature length Spike Jonze. So I went in with absolutely no expectations, except I knew what the movie was about. So I went in thinking, oh, this could be so creative. And to me, it wasn't creative. It was just a nice twist on something that I had seen before. But good movie, not to my liking.
All right. Well, that's it for our talk at the New York Film Festival. For more coverage of the festival, go to thefilmstage.com. We will wrap up in our usual way. Let's just talk about the two new films that are coming to Blu-ray and DVD and whether or not they're worth checking out. The first is The Heat. Did anyone see The Heat?
No.
Okay,
I didn't see The Heat.
No. Let's just talk about Pacific Rim.
Oh, God.
Okay.
That was an interesting film about the robots fighting.
Yeah, it was.
I think I came down, because I don't think, you guys all talked about it on the podcast, but I haven't said anything yet.
Yeah,
so.
No, Jordan, why don't you give us your thoughts on Pacific Rim?
Yeah.
Worth a buy? Worth a rental?
Yeah, worth the rental, I guess. That's a movie that, I was super excited for some reason. and then it was actually, Brian, your take on it, I think. When I read your review, I was like, oh, crap, that's what I was hoping it wasn't going to be like. And still, the first time I actually saw it twice in theaters, because TFS co-founder Dan hadn't seen it yet, and so I dragged myself along with him. And yeah,
when TFS co-founders get together.
Yeah, you go see stupid movies. No. And just the second time watching it, like, everything that was fun in the first go around, just so much to a lesser degree, and everything that stuck out like a sore thumb, which was Charlie Hunnam's, like, probably the worst performance given in a studio temple this year, and that, yeah, and I just, it was just laughable, and I don't think, I've heard in interviews that Guillermo del Toro has said that that was kind of his intention, but,
Did you get a chance to check this out?
Yeah, and my question is, if you had any interest in this movie, why didn't you go see the big giant spectacle film special effects while it was in theaters?
No, I saw it twice in theaters.
No, I mean, I don't mean you specifically.
Oh, but people who
generally
are listening,
if somebody is listening to this thinking, like, I wouldn't want to rent it if I wanted to see it, because it's just a giant spectacle,
right.
And
if I
put that movie on that TV in front of me without having seen it, I feel like I wouldn't be that into it. But seeing it in theaters, I was kind of into it. So I would say, don't rent it. If you missed it, it's not the end of the world. But hopefully, you caught it in, because it is kind of fun.
Go the rest of your life without seeing it.
If you're a Del Toro diehard, there's. I guess
this will make you sad, though, if you're a Del Toro diehard.
It will.
Well, if you're Del Toro or diehard, you probably already saw it. So.
Also true.
I don't know. If you haven't seen it, I would say it's not necessary to catch up on it.
Yeah.
Okay. Is someone crumbling paper into their microphone, Nick?
No, I was looking at a folder of paper.
Of
fantastic.
Course.
Put it away.
I'm trying to. The paper's. Okay.
what is the paper
doing? It was stuck.
Can we talk about the best film of the New York Film Festival?
Yeah, we didn't. We missed one, Brian.
Oh, we did. What did we say?
Inside Llewellyn Davis.
Oh,
okay.
Or
no, or damn. No. We didn't talk about Only Lovers Left Alive.
Oh yeah, Vince.
Oh. Okay.
Damn, that's
save it for 2014 when it comes
out.
Yeah,
I guess when it finally comes out.
This is what 12 Years a Slave. A few of us did.
Well, 12 Years a Slave. We can
save
talk
it.
About.
Yeah.
Right
we should. We should
probably.
Tell.
Yeah. We're going to be having a full episode on that briefly or shortly. So.
Go see it, though, when it comes out.
Excellent. So that let's talk about what's coming to theaters, then. We have Carrie, the reimagining. Are they going from the movie or the book? Does it matter?
They're definitely.
They claim they're going from the book, but they're definitely going from the movie.
The book is, the book is actually written...
Such a good way to put it.
The book is written in a... I don't know how to pronounce this word. Epistolary manner?
Epistolary.
Epistolary. Thank you, Forrest. Wherein you take from different... fake documents such as newspaper clippings and court transcripts and whatnot to tell the story. By all accounts, unless the marketing has been very clever in hiding this, the movie is not following that realm and it's not following that lead. And so I don't know.
Well, I mean, to the movie's credit, this is like a
a new vision for a new generation. I wouldn't want them to.
I mean, there is the, you know, we've had a lot in the news lately about bullying and blah, blah, blah of kids, and no one's as tough as they used to be. I'm just going to cut that out because that makes me sound really unsympathetic. So we've had a lot of talk about, you know, cyberbullying and things of that nature. So I assume that they'll get into that. But really, it's just like new ways to torture the girl before she flips out and murders everyone. Spoiler alert to a thing that was in the trailer.
Wow, Brian.
So, but it is by also Kimberly
Pierce.
Also,
it's like a colloquialism.
A colloquialism?
Yeah. No. Well, not a colloquialism. Wow. Can you cut that one out too?
No, that's no, I mean,
pulling a carry is like a joke that everybody has heard before.
Yeah.
I don't think it's like a big Star Wars spoiler that I won't say because somebody will inevitably be upset, but you can't really spoil Carrie.
I mean, yeah, you just assume so, but
also I just watched the original like I think less than a year ago for the first time and totally holds up all 98 minutes
terrifying.
And so that's on Netflix Instant. You can just watch that and save a lot of money. So
well, this movie is 1 minute longer. So
yeah.
Anyway, also coming out is The Fifth Estate, which is we talked about this briefly, I believe. Although I'm not sure if we were recording. It's the drama about the WikiLeaks, which is like a thing that's still happening.
Is it still around?
They leaked the script for the WikiLeaks movie at the state.
Did they?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's crazy. I mean, they also had, like, there was a documentary that came out called We Steal Secrets, and I don't know. I don't know why we needed the fictionalized version so
quickly.
One is
not getting a good review. So
no.
It's always tough to cover five whole estates in a movie. So it's pretty ambitious.
No. They did four estates. This is the fifth estate.
Yeah.
I can just tell, like, on a concept level, like, I didn't think Condon had it in him to do five whole estates.
It's not called five estates. It's called the fifth estate, like Nick pointed
out. Only the fifth estate.
They're only doing the one.
Which is just crazy, because how can you get it unless you... Do they tell you what the other four estates are? Because I'm serious. Like, they refer to journalism as the fourth estate, and it's just like... But what are the other three, or is anyone even going to get that
reference?
Probably
in the post...
You have to at least address the
legislative and judicial.
There it is.
Okay.
Now we don't have to go through the movie. Thanks, Boris.
I'm just imagining that, like, there's like an opening Chiron where it's like Estate 1, Estate 2, and then the fifth estate like comes up on the screen, and then like a Gravity style hard cut to silence, and just Benedict Cumberbatch staring at you.
Life anyway. In the fifth estate is impossible.
Also coming out, like we said, is All Is Lost. Also another independent film, Kill Your Darlings. Escape Plan, which has Sylvester Stallone and Arnold Schwarzenegger, also coming out. A movie that we didn't talk about from New York Film Festival is hitting very limited release, and we will talk about it when it expands, because this, of course, is one of my most anticipated films of the year, and that is 12 Years a Slave, the newest film by Steve McQueen. I'm assuming some of you were able to check this out.
Oh, yeah. It's a great movie.
You want to give me, like, a tweet-sized version of what you thought of it?
I loved it, and it's a great, great movie that everyone should see.
This sounds like a third grader giving a book report in front of the class.
I was picturing you with your fingers up, like, doing the count. He's like, oh, God, tweet-sized. 140 characters. If I say C, but I mean C, the letter, then you know...
No,
I was sort of counting the words in my head, trying to make sure it didn't get up to 150.
That's right. No, but if you live in a major city, it's actually a little wider. The 18 theaters, so it's more than the normal, like 2 to 4 theaters that they do. So you could see it this weekend, potentially.
Yeah, it's a very good film, but I do think, I don't know, I don't want to say it's overpraised, because what does that really mean? But
I love it when you say shit like that.
But I mean, I'm not on the masterpiece bandwagon, which so many people seem so eager to jump aboard back when I played at festivals. It's very good, but it has problems. It has problems. So what's
sounds like a movie.
Calm down, yeah.
It has problems. It's very good.
My only problem with it was that it was too good.
All right. This is the movie that Madonna got banned from the Draft House because she was apparently on her phone.
Oh, yeah. She got banned from the Draft House?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. She wasn't there.
No. But no. They just don't want her kind in there.
Yeah, I'm sure she's very upset.
Preemptive. It was a preemptive, yeah.
Anyway, anyone else thoughts on 12 Years a Slave?
I didn't see it, so no thoughts.
Looking forward to it.
It's really, like, not as funny as I was thinking. It was, like, really disappointing.
Chiwetel Ejiofor is such, like, a gifted comedic actor.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I thought it was going to be really, like, it just wasn't, like, that fun. Like, it was kind of...
A little rough, that story of a guy being sold to slavery.
I predict it will be Brian's favorite movie of the year.
Oh, shit.
Wow.
I mean, throwing it out there.
He was pretty high on Gravity, man.
I was high on Gravity. There was nothing holding me down.
How many times does Sandra Bullock say the N-word in Gravity?
Jesus. So, uh-huh. I was just going to say that last year I complained that I really, like, was just padding out the, like, bottom five of my top 10. And this year there's actually going to be some real fighting for the 10 spot and below. Like, it's like there's been a lot of really good movies this year.
Yeah, this year's been really good, I think. And it's been especially good for American films compared to last year, at least for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of interesting cinema out there to be devoured.
Body Saints.
Oh, yeah, Brian, I have to give you props.
Before Midnight.
I'm sorry, I'm getting props for what?
Your Anthem Body Saints praise, because I'm with you.
All right, excellent. Because that actually is what's sort of maybe sitting at my number one.
Forrest really likes that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have a soul, you love that movie.
All right.
Nick just made a noise. All right, well, let's very quickly say something that we watched on our own this week, and then we can all get back to our lives. So, Nick Newman, what's something that you watched on your own that you think people should take a look at?
God, I saw, like, nothing. I was so busy. That's really depressing. So let me just name a movie I watched, maybe. Why not? I watched Roberto Rossellini's The Flowers of St. Francis from 1950.
Okay.
Which is indeed about St. Francis of Assisi and his friars. Episodic motion picture. It's something only, like, 80 minutes or so. It is a very fast-paced movie, which is strange for... sort of this period piece about St. Francis of Assisi. Good movie. I don't know. I just wrote a paper on this film, so, like, I can't really talk about it anymore. I handed it in yesterday. I was kind of at that point where I was like, I can't speak to it anymore. But no, if you're a Rossellini fan, I think you'll quite enjoy it, especially sort of its placement in his career. The sort of the reflection it has on his other movies, or something I put in my paper. I don't know. God. Okay.
All right.
Good film.
Danny King, what about yourself?
Saw a film called 10 Rillington Place.
Okay.
That title refers to the address of a man named John Christie, who is a serial killer man.
Serial killer man.
Serial killer man.
Which is a disturbing life choice.
That's not as disturbing as the fact that you said serial killer man.
Yeah, no, that's probably not even the right term, honestly. Because
it's just serial killer.
It's what his business card says.
He's just a serial killer. A serial killer man would be like the person who hands out serial killers.
But yeah, like the like the poster on IMDb, the tagline is like, "What happened to the women at 10 Rillington Place?" Well, they were, like, killed. So.
Fantastic,
but,
Danny.
Yeah, like, the director of this film, his name is Richard Fleischer, and he's pretty famous for, like, Soylent Green, that film. And I kind of want to dig into more of his, like, crime stuff, like this movie, because a lot of it is pretty respected. And this film, you know, in addition to the sort of morbidly enjoyable serial killer plot, it tackles very seriously issues of capital punishment and also abortion for a film made in 1971. There's a lot of frank and explicit discussion and execution of the act of abortion. It was interesting to see this film at MoMA, because a lot of people tend to stroll into the theaters without really knowing what they're going to see. So there were a lot of comments between people kind of like, this is kind of a creepy movie. So I enjoyed that as well as the film.
All right. Excellent. Jordan Rapp, what about yourself?
Let's see. Well, I've been watching, for some ungodly reason, all the Best Picture winners.
Whoa.
Yeah, and I'll just, this is my review of all of them. Don't ever do that. It's just, I think there's like 60 something, yeah. And I had seen half of them or so. And so those are all the good ones. And, there were the rest that no one has just ever heard of. And,
how do you like How Green Was My Valley?
Yeah, that was a decent one out of the bunch. But there's some, I just watched one called The Broadway Melody, which is like just around the time when sound, I think it was one of the first sound pictures. And, it's just because of that, I think it got, it won. I'd have to see, but it's more or less like just like a TV pilot or something that's stretched out into a feature length movie. Just exactly what you'd expect. But yeah,
sounds pretty tight.
Yeah, there were some high points, I would say, out of like 30 or so that I watched. I had never seen From Here to Eternity, which is a solid romantic, kind of like a sweeping Hollywood romance set around the World War II, which was pretty good, and Marty, which is a good movie about this kind of like a guy who lives with his mom in New York City and is trying to have a relationship, and just kind of is a little outside the norm of what like the 20 plus other movies I saw, which were just kind of like just what you expect. And it kind of gave me newfound appreciation for my current lack of interest in the Oscars. Just it made me realize that, you know, stuff like The Artist and King's Speech won't, I mean, they barely remember now, but in come 20 years they'll be like one of these movies, so it just made me a little happier. So I guess in that aspect it's worth it.
And Forrest, what of yourself?
Quick thought on Marty is, or piece of trivia, it's one of, I think, two movies to win Best Picture and the Palme d'Or. Anyway, Trouble nice. Every Day, I caught at BAM yesterday.
Yeah.
And if we want to talk about incredible Tinder stick scores in Claire Denis movies, I listened to all of them last night because of this movie, and it's my favorite one. But there's not much in the way of narrative, which is completely fine, because it's just this sort of impressionistic journey of, you have a couple who goes to Paris, and you've got this vampire cannibal type of thing going on. And I think it's a fourth reel has just, I think, one of the most incredible scenes I've ever seen in any movie. And I don't even know what to say about it. It sounds like most of you guys have seen it, and you probably know which scene I'm talking about. But
is it like the really short dialogue scene for like 10 seconds?
Yeah, there's not much dialogue in it at all, but it's just a beautiful, beautiful, almost surreal take on the horror genre. And it takes a little bit, well, it opens very, very strong, but it can take a little bit to get into, but it's absolutely hypnotic once you do. And I will be thinking about that scene for a very long time. And I need to watch it again, which I'll probably do tomorrow because movie pass. Trouble Every Day, Claire Denis, 2001. Not well received at its time. And I think people are going to like this movie if they get the chance to see it. Good movie. Good stuff.
Excellent. I'm torn. I'm torn between what to talk about. So I was in Texas, and me and a couple friends decided that we were going to watch one of our favorite movies to watch together, and that is the film that we almost know all the lines of, so we can watch it while drinking and carousing and everything like that. Nick Newman, put away those fucking papers. This was the directorial debut of Matthew Vaughn, and it is the Daniel Craig starring movie Layer Cake. Has anyone seen Layer Cake?
I have.
I love this film. It's stylish, well-written, well-paced, interesting, vaguely convoluted, but still makes some sense. Crime thriller from the UK. And Daniel Craig stars as a businessman whose commodity happens to be cocaine. And he's plunged into the seedy underbelly of his criminal enterprise world when he's asked by a higher-up to find the missing daughter of... another drug kingpin. It's a really good, great soundtrack, clever editing, and it's I don't know. I just like it a lot. It's entertaining. I'm never not in the mood to watch it. So, yeah, I don't know what everyone else thought about it, but I
do. Do you honestly understand the plot of that film?
I do.
I've only seen it once, and I did not understand it. I thought it was almost incomprehensible.
Oh no! I mean, I got it from the first time I saw it.
Oh.
Wow!
It's all there for you, Nick.
Well, no, I mean, I'm sure it is, but sort of. The first time I was seeing it, all the thick British accents and characters with similar names and double crossing. I enjoyed it, but I didn't really know what I was looking at.
I see. All right. Excellent. So that's mine.
Brian accepts it.
I'll accept your statements. I still love to tell people whenever they talk about thick accents in movies about the time I went to see The Wind That Shakes the Barley at the local art house theater.
Oh, yeah.
And the blistering confusion that spread through the crowd for the first 20 minutes because they just kept expecting subtitles.
I had to watch it with subtitles.
Oh, that sucks.
No joke.
I think I did too.
Like I turned on subtitles in that movie because I'm just not good with accents.
And that's not like Hollywood Irish accents. That's like real rural Northern Irish. It's difficult, but I got it.
I just
did the same thing with
the
Fish
theater.
Tank. Fish Tank and
oh yeah, Fish Tank's tough.
Danny, but you were picturing people in
theater. Just like looking at each other, panicking, like, where the F for the subtitles?
Yeah, no, like, everyone was like, it was funny because I was
like,
watching,
they're running
like,
around.
I got this. And they just kept looking at each other and they were wondering if something was wrong. And I was like, they're speaking English ish. All right. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Like I said, we'll be back again next week to talk about Escape from Tomorrow, the independent film that premiered at Sundance that was shot at Disneyland and Disney World. And you should be here because that's going to obviously lead to some interesting discussion. So let's tell everyone where you can be found between now and then. Let's start with the guests. Jordan Raup, where can we find you online?
Oh, yeah. On the film stage, tweeting at the film stage and at JP Raup.
And Forrest.
Mostly on Twitter, and also I run a blog. If you Google Force and Focus, that'll show up. I might have something for the film stage later, but if you really, really miss me, Twitter is the place to go.
All right. Would you like to tell us what your Twitter handle is?
Yes, F Cardamenus.
Right.
That's Cardamenus.
All right.
I'd like to commend Force's tweets because they always are interesting,
masterful.
Yeah, and beautiful. So actually, all you guys are actually. I just want to
thank you.
Say aww, you guys all do a good job.
Thanks, boss.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And Danny King.
Yeah, also thefilmstage.com, thekingbulletin.com, and the Twitter handle would also be thekingbulletin.
Excellent. You can find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net. You can also find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan, and on the film stage, where, of course, we're going to post this podcast. So thank you, ladies and gentlemen, once again for sticking with us and listening to our thoughts on film, and we will talk to you next week.